Okay, thank you very much, comrade. Could I ask you if you wish to make a comment or put a question, or indicate via the chat that you wish to either make put a question or make a contribution. I can see that Howard has got a copy of your clans and clearances.
Oh, good for him!
Okay. Could you use the chat, please, so that I can arrange an order for people to speak?
Okay, I'll click on chat. There, I've clicked on it.
I'll take Moggy then, and then I'll take Stanislav. Moggy then Stanislav, please.
Okay. Well, thank you for a very amazing and entertaining talk, and I could listen to you all day, really. I don't want you to wind up right now. That was wonderful. But, one thing has occurred to me. Weren't the Scots more interested in what was happening with the French Revolution at the time?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, it happened. The French Revolution, the clearances really started in 1750 or even 1740. French Revolution, 1789. The Highland landlords were afraid that a lot of naughty people were going around the Highlands trying to rouse opposition to the clearances. And there were even rumours that the book, B92, I forget what, the chap, Tom Paine's books. This is the rumour. I'm sure, I don't think it was true. The rumour was that Tom Paine's books had been translated into Gaelic and were being handed around by the Highlanders. I do not think there's anything in that rumour, but they were certainly afraid that people would rise up. But by that time, I'm afraid any kind of rising was out of the question. Very sad, but there you are. Sorry.
Thank you.
Stanislav, do you want to come in, please?
Okay, I'm turning up. I apologize for sometimes I'm going to work and doesn't listen this interesting. How correctly said the interesting interview. By the way, I have some questions about the Scotland and Wales. When I heard about the languages in the Scotland, I heard the difference between lowlands Englishes, yep. Lowland languages and Highlands Englishes,
yep.
Languages. When I heard about the Highlands, English, I remember the Scots language, which located in lowlands. What about the, how correctly said, the, wait a second, the situation with education, with studying and etc. in the Scotland, with Scots, and what happened in the Wales right now with the independence movement? Because I would like to say, make the Wales independent, and we need for the anyone with Gimre. Thank you.
Yes, very interesting. When you talk to people about England, they assume that everybody in England is English. There aren't any other places. But in fact, there's down in Cornwall, the relatives of the Welsh people are getting their language, Cornish, started again, which in fact died out in 1785, but some people now speak it. In Welsh, I spent 2 years working in a Welsh coal mine, so they've the longest 2 years of my life, believe me. And it was interesting, I picked up a bit of Welsh there. There was still a bit of Welsh, even though most it's further into Wales, West Wales and North Wales, that Welsh is still spoken. But it is still spoken by many hundreds, many thousands of people, Welsh, and is a living language. As far as Scotland is concerned, The Lowlanders and the Highlanders were always different. You have to give credit to the Lowlands. They were always well ahead of even the English in things like statistics. Statistics, as a word, was coined, was made up by Sir John Sinclair, a Scotsman. And he got everybody, in fact, the Scottish people had got a chap called Dr. Webster in the 1750s to find out the population of every parish in Scotland, a long way ahead of anything that the English had ever done. And then 1790s, Sir John Sinclair wrote to all the ministers of every parish in Scotland. They got them to write a report on their parish. So it could be half a page, it could be 30 pages long. And he published all these reports in a series, 20 volumes, called The Statistical Account of Scotland. And it's absolutely full of... beyond price, the information that it has, and a long way ahead of anything the English had done. And furthermore, the Scots were always ahead of the English with education. In fact, they always had schools before the English had schools. And there are some people, although I've gone along with all these Lowlanders who now call their language English, some Lowlanders say it is so different from English that it is now really a separate language, and they call it Doric. And if you are talking to somebody from Glasgow, you may, if you can speak English, you may get dubious and doubtful about whether he is speaking English at all, because it can be very broad. But I've spent enough time up in Scotland to be able just to understand the Glaswegian accent, thank goodness. Is that okay?
Okay. Okay, comrade. I'll take Mike Foster next. Mike Foster, please.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, that was really entertaining. I enjoyed that. I can't say I sort of know too much about the subject before now. My only way in has been the film Culloden by Peter Watkins, made for the BBC in the mid-1960s. Yeah. Peter Watkins is quite a filmmaker, a hero of mine, and his aim with that was to sort of humanise the events of the Battle of Culloden.
Yeah.
And by filming as if a TV film crew had magically appeared at the time. I was just wondering if you'd seen the film and if that gives a sort of a useful perspective on the Battle of Culloden, or maybe if you could briefly sort of give a bit of detail about the battle itself, because I'm a bit rusty on the details myself. But yeah, thanks very much.
Thank you. No, it's the trouble always came. I was talking earlier on about Protestant versus Catholic, and the English finally decided that James II was definitely a Catholic. And although they were prepared to put up with him while he was alive, on the grounds that he couldn't live forever, and as soon as he died, the crown would descend to one of his two daughters, both of whom were Protestant. So all you did have to do, because the majority of the English people by then and the Scots were Protestant, so all you had to do was to wait for James II to die, and you were there, because a Protestant queen would take over. And then Richard James II spoils all this marvellous plan by marrying again. The woman he married got pregnant, came to bed, and had a baby boy. So then who was going to be brought up as a Catholic? And of course, a boy comes before a girl in the inheritance of the throne. So the two much older sisters would be pushed to one side, and the little baby boy, a Catholic, would come to the throne. So the Protestants passed the lie, complete lie, around that he wasn't a proper baby boy. It had been, they found a baby somewhere and brought it into the bed in a warming pan. You used to have to a warming pan with burning cinders in it to keep the bed warm. And the theory was, it was a lie, that they brought the baby in the warming pan and pushed it in. And then she grabbed hold of the baby and said, "Ho-hoy, I've got a baby." You see, the warming pan baby. Anyway, the trouble was that from then on, you couldn't say, "Oh, well, we'll have to stay with the king because, you know, divine right of kings," because as soon as he dies, there's going to be another Catholic. And so that was the end of James II. And opinion turned against him so much, he ran off to the continent. William III came over, who was the husband of one of the previous king's daughters, and William and Mary, Protestants, succeeded to the throne. But from then onwards, all those people who said, "Well, yes, we prefer Protestants to Catholics, but nevertheless, the right of, you know, birth, it should be the Stuart king, because the warming pan baby, so-called, grew up to be the old pretender." And there was a rebellion in 1715 and another one in 1719 to try and put him on the throne. And indeed, he was still around in 1745. He wasn't dead. And the rebellion, his son, the young pretender, came over and roused mainly Catholics, but also some Protestants, to stand up for the right of older people to succeed to the throne. And they and the London people, the Hanoverians, by this time, they had the two daughters, Protestant daughters, one after the other, William and Mary, they died without any children, or they had about 15 children, they all died. And then Queen Anne also came to the throne. She had 19 children, they all died in those days, and if the Queen couldn't keep the children alive, I don't know who else would. So they died, and then they had to go to, they had to pass over about the next 300 people on the family tree because they were Catholics. And they finally ended up with a German princeling who came over from Hanover, and he was made George I. But there were still the people who said, "Oh, the old Stuarts, we should go for them." And in 1745, Prince Charles came over, roused a Highland army, some Catholics, but even Protestants, who thought, you know, the elders should follow, and who were fairly hostile to the English anyway. And he had a lot of success to start with. And in fact, from the place in the Highlands he started, marching to London, he got three quarters of the way to a town, Derby, which is still there. In fact, the vanguard had gone just south of Derby, a mile south, to a place called Swarkston. Swarkston Bridge over the Thames. I've been there, and I can imagine the vanguard having got there. And then the word comes, "We've changed our mind, too dangerous, we'll have to go back to Scotland." But they got three quarters of the way, and George II, as it was then, was packing up to go back to Hanover and forget about it. But in the end, poor old Prince Charles was defeated, went all the way back up to Scotland, up to Culloden Moor, and he was, he was a very romantic figure, but he wasn't very good at taking good advice. And he accepted advice to have a nocturnal raid on the English. And the result was it failed. And all these people came back wet and tired. And that was part of his army when the Battle of Culloden War was fought. And he was beaten quite easily. So that was the end of the Stuart idea of getting the Stuarts back to rule over Britain. So I did see...
Okay, thanks. Yeah, cheers.
Okay.
I'll take Darren O'Neill next, and then Howard, and then if the meeting will allow me, I'd like to put a question to you.
But, okay. But
Darren, then Howard, then me.
Yeah, fine.
Hi, Owen. Thanks for the talk. It's very enjoyable. I was interested how you sort of made the point that part of our misunderstanding about the history of the Hiring Clearances is because of historians kind of writing upon each other, writing on top of each other, just kind of repeating the old kind of myths, which your book has sought to kind of challenge and sort of put to one side. I don't pretend to know a lot about Highland Clearances. So I'm wondering what your opinion is of John Preble's book. Preble's book, because obviously I have a sort of smattering of knowledge of Scottish history, and when somebody mentions the Highland Clearances to me, I guess I think of Preble's book, and I'm wondering if Preble's book as part of that historic tradition which you're sort of arguing against, or did he actually kind of also, like yourself, kind of tackle some of these myths that had been built up over a number of years? Thank you.
John Preble, in fact, it was because I was working in a publisher's. I'd already spent years working on the Highland Clearances, aiming to write a book. I was working in a publisher's office, and the bookseller came out. I opened the bookseller to read it. There was an advert: John Preble is producing a book on the Highland Clearances this autumn. So when I got home, I started my book. That was in 1963. If he hadn't produced the book, I wonder if I'd have started yet. But anyway, Preble, yes, it's what they call populist history. I wouldn't look down on it at all. It's possibly he is saying what was in people's minds, which he had to do a bit of guesswork at. But I wouldn't object to Preble's book. There are one or two mistakes poor old Preble does get wrong by following, for example, this enormous population increase between 1750 and 1800. He's got it there. But give him credit. He did his best, and he talked about it. When I was doing history at college in the 1940s, you didn't even mention the Highland Clearances. It was incredible. It was more interesting the things you didn't talk about than the things you did talk about. You didn't talk about slavery, for example. Well, you didn't talk about slavery until 1807, when the noble, heroic British Navy stopped the slave trade. And that was always emphasised enormously in history books, ignoring the fact that the British people had made an enormous profit out of the slave trade for the past 200 years, which was always smoothed over. So I'm all in favour of as many history books as possible. As I say, Preble did get one or two things wrong, but he did talk about the events which had been, you could have got a book on the high, on a book of Scottish history before 1963, when his book came out, in which virtually the whole history of the Highlands after the Battle of Culloden was half a page. You know, the Highland clearances were swept away, so you didn't ever hear about them. So I'm in favour of Preble for having publicised their clearances. That's my
Thanks. Just to clarify, you're talking a book called Glencoe, aren't you, Alwyn? Is it titled
well, Glencoe? Well, in the 1690s, the massacre of Glencoe, that wasn't part of the clearances.
I meant you've just been, Preble was the author of a text called Glencoe. I just wanted to clarify that for the meeting. Is that okay?
Yes.
So, okay, can I take the next question now then?
He wrote half a dozen books.
Okay.
All of them are very good.
We'll try to get a list afterwards. We'll try to get a list of these texts afterwards for people's information. I'll take you next then, please.
Yeah.
And then Freddie.
Yeah.
Howard, you're muted.
It's not a question, this. I just wanted to make some comments on the book.
Certainly.
It's okay. Wait for this. It is 729 pages long.
Yeah.
And it's the first volume out of a planned five.
Yeah.
I see
four
that.
More.
You've got four more planned. I don't know if they're all going to be the same length. You've got plenty of time to do it in. Okay. Right. It's a monumental piece of work, and it's tremendously well documented. The documentation is absolutely scrupulous, and it's so well indexed as well. Somebody asked a question about Culloden. I looked at Culloden in the index, and it's actually signalled 110 times. So you obviously know a fair amount about Culloden, because you mentioned it in the course of this book 110 times. I counted them. I just wanted to say, that's all I wanted to say, a word or two about the nature of this book. It's tremendous sort of thoroughness, breadth, and, you know, you only have to sort of look at it briefly to see how much work and scholarship has gone into it. Well done.
It's only volume one.
And that's only volume one.
And when you say they're the same length, on the average, they are the same length. Volume three, which deals with the Sutherland clearances, is even longer, I'm afraid. That's going to come out very soon, volume two and volume three. Hardly anybody has bought it. I'm very glad to meet one of the very few people who's actually bought it. I have to say that three or four people have bought it, and they very kindly wrote in to say it was a great book. In fact, if you want to look at Glen Discovery, one chap was kind enough to actually create a website in which he spent his time saying, you must go and buy this book. I didn't do it. I don't know who he is, but Glen Discovery, have a look at that. So it's lovely when people do say that. Thank you very much. Very kind.
Okay, welcome.
Can we take a contribution from Comrade Edwards now then? Freddie Edwards, please.
Yeah, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, good. Listen,
if you've gone a bit further back, I could see your mouth as well. That's lovely.
Right, good. Let me say, Alwyn, that was one of the best addresses and discussions that I've heard for a long, long time, honestly.
Oh.
And you'll probably tell from the accent where I'm from originally, Glasgow. And I understand what you're saying about the Glaswegian accent. But, you know, on this, I mean, you've some of what you've told me, I had no knowledge of at all, despite Scotland being my place of birth. But it's when you talk about the clearance.
Freddie, lift your head so you can see.
Sorry. Can you see me? Yeah.
You're lovely. Thank you.
Okay, good. Sorry. So I'll try and be as brief as I can here, just to try and see the link that when you're talking about the Highland clearances and where the sort of demarcation line between the lowlands and the highlands.
Yeah.
My recollection is that many people describe the sort of Stirling as the gateway to the highlands. That's my recollection, that Stirling was the gateway to the highlands. But going back several hundred years, I mean, clearly I remember about being taught about William Wallace, etc. at school, long before the 1700s. You're talking the late 13th century.
Yeah.
So, and Wallace and Edward I having a battle at Stirling Bridge.
Yeah.
So what was the purpose of all these battles? And because 300 years earlier or thereabouts, before the 1700s, what was the purpose of those battles if they weren't already trying to move further forward, the English, so to put it, moving further forward? Is there any link at all between them? But I'll finish at that and just say again, what a wonderful, wonderful, I've thoroughly enjoyed this evening, the best one I can remember for a long time. So thanks, Alwyn. And I will try and get your book.
Thank you. It's lovely to hear that accent. I've never lived in Scotland. I've lived almost everywhere else. But when I was in South Wales in the coal mine, I remember shaking a great friend of mine from Glasgow. And I said, come on, John, it's 4:45. You have to get... I'm not going to work the day. So
I understood what you said there, all right.
I got enough Glasgow action. And the trouble was, I've lived in so many different places that I've picked up such a lot of accent. And I've been in Scotland, opened the car window, asked a passerby, could you tell me? And he said, no bother, you see. And when he's done it, I almost say thank you in a Scottish accent, but he's asking for a bunch of fives. But it's such a catching accent that I could spend the rest of my life talking in Glaswegian. I belong to Glasgow. That's my favourite tune.
So, as long as you never get the Glasgow kiss.
Oh, Owen, yeah. see if you can cope with the Lancashire accent now for a minute, please. Oh. I'd just like to ask a question about you're talking about the clans.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in the type of agriculture that they were using, because in other parts of Europe, I understand that there was a lot of common ownership of land, and for example, there would be redistribution of land amongst every so often, yeah, amongst a particular group, whether it be a clan or whatever.
Yeah.
Was this the case in the Scottish clans, as far as you know? Or,
yes.
Could I just ask a supplementary question?
Yeah.
Mark spends quite a lot of time at the end of Volume 1 of Capital, talking about the clearances. Do you think that, would you accept the accuracy of what he says, or would we need to adjust our view on the basis of subsequent research?
No, what he says is absolutely true. And when he was saying it, nobody was, it was pushed under the carpet, ignored. Marx, as with everything else, was prepared to say what nobody else was prepared to say. And what he said about the Sutherland clearances, very brief, but it was absolutely true. And a final word on the language. I took my granny when I was at school in Manchester, took my granny to Old Trafford. She'd never been to a cricket match. I tried to explain. The batsman scored a century. Everybody applauded. He held up his bat. So my granny said in a loud accent, "Has he won?" I tried to pretend I wasn't with her.
Right. Am I going to get an answer to my first question about the organisation of agriculture?
That is absolutely true. The joint farms, because it was so much emphasised that everybody should, as far as possible, have an equal chance, some of the land would be a bit better than other bits. So they would swap them round every year. They called it run rig because they had the long, thin stretches of land were called rigs, and they swapped them round. You had a good rig last time, you'll have a not quite so good rig this time. And the poor chap had a bad go last time, he'll get a better bag. And in those joint farms, there was very much of a communal feeling. If a man was ill, the others would do his work for him while he was ill. And if anybody in the farm died, they would stop work for the day. There was proper respect for the people around them, which you didn't get when they all went to a Manchester cotton mill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Paul, I've already recognised Stanislav. So I'll take Paul next after Stanislav, please.
Okay.
Okay, I guess this is the first question because in my clockers is 11 p.m. So I heard about the situation with the television in the countries like Wales, because I remember when in the 1979 countries and Labour's country or Conservatives and the Labour's party decided to agitate it from the Wales people. They told we can start the channel with only translate in the Welsh language, channel Pedwar Cymru. And I remember in Scotland you had the channel which can translate it in the languages like Scots and Scottish Gaelic. And I can say it. What happened in the independent journalists, independent channels with languages like Scottish Gaelic and Welsh language? Because in my country, I represent Russia. We have a very big troubles with the independent journalistics in the regional languages, because they are destroyed maybe after the last 20 or 30 years. And people who can spoken, for example, in the Chuvashi language or the Dagestan language doesn't have opportunities to give the independent information. But what happened in the Scotland and Wales with independent journalistics?
Well, Wales Wales is really reinvigorating its language, and a number of English people who live in Wales or English-speaking people are sending their children to an ysgol, rather a school, a Welsh-speaking school, and there is no reason why people cannot speak two languages. I was at school in London during the war. The school was full of people who'd fled from Europe, and almost everybody spoke at least two languages. I remember one person, as far as I remember, it's about five. One language with her mum, one with her dad, one with her granny, And you can't do it because every language helps you with every other language. As far as Scotland is concerned, the Lowlands and the Highlands are so different that they will have to be treated separately. Whether Gaelic can now be brought alive, I don't know. Of the three Gaelic languages, Irish is still being kept going, and I've spoken to a Highlander who was able to turn on the Irish radio and understand it. The third Gaelic language was Manx, and the last person to speak Manx just died some time ago. So that's the three. But as far as Welsh is concerned, there are three languages there: Welsh, Cornish and Breton, which are still mutually intelligible. And in fact, when I lived down in Jersey, a Breton troupe came over dancing and singing, and they did a song, and I suddenly realised what it was. It was the Welsh national anthem sung about five times as fast. In the centuries since they've been separated, they've got a lot faster. But it was the same song. So you could still talk, you know, those three could still talk to each other.
There's a very interesting discussion to be had about language, politics, state centralisation and repression. I don't think we've really got time to go into it at the moment. It'd be great to bring that up at another meeting, I think, Stanislav, if that's okay. According to Comrade O'Neill, he believes that there are only about 50,000 people in Scotland that speak Gaelic.
Yeah.
Just another comment for Stanislav, that there are independent, it's not just the state television that runs local languages in Wales, for example, but the BBC certainly does these national languages. But if we can save that possible discussion for another time, I'd like to take Comrade Paul Edwards, who's also from Scotland.
Thanks, Steve. Yes, and thank you to Alwyn. Yeah, tremendous, very, very interesting talk. Probably learn more in the short time we've been together than what I did in 4 years of secondary school. It really was most enlightening and very, very much appreciated. You clearly put a lot of time and energy into producing those books. I mean, I've got an absolute ton of questions I'd like to ask, not least of all, you know, what really triggered your interest? You know, why did you choose this particular subject, or did it choose you? So that's one thing you can maybe answer if possible. The other thing I was going to say, there's certainly a resurgence of Gaelic and Doric language being spoken in school. They're all new builds now, have their own new build schools, that is, have their own Gaelic department, and it's optional. You know, children have got now the choice of speaking the traditional French, German, Italian, and they can now choose Gaelic if they wish to. So there's certainly a lot more interest in it. BBC Scotland have their own channel called BBC Alaba, and they show live football games along with Gaelic commentary. It's the word I'm looking for. So yeah, I mean, they're certainly trying to keep that kind of stuff alive, and it, you know, it can, you know, tradition can be quite a good thing. As long as
I agree 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. So another, just one final thing. Are you partial to a whiskey? And if so, what's your favourite tipple? Dram. Thanks, Alan. I'll leave it at that. Thank you. I'll just put myself on mute again, guys. Go on, mate.
Right, thank you. Yes, why I'm interested in the Highland, I do not know. I've always been interested in family history. I've traced my family back. I've got eight English great grandparents. They're all born in England. They lived in England. They died in England. I cannot claim a single drop of Scottish blood, I'm afraid. But my mother was of some rather advanced opinions, and the thing she said stuck in my mind for a long time, and I remember her denouncing the Sutherland clearances. And even though I was a small boy, it lived with me. And afterwards, when I began to be old enough to read for myself, I began to read, and it was being brushed aside. As I said earlier, though I studied history, I actually read history at university. There's no possible smidgen of Highland clearances was ever mentioned. In fact, Britain is England, and England is London, if you're not very careful. So it's a great shame that these separate parts of the country should not have their memories, their history, their language kept going. And when I was studying the Highland clearances, it's going back now to 1750, very often I was able to decide whether a parish Highland or not, because was it speaking Gaelic or not? Now this is in Perthshire. Nowadays, it's gone and gone and gone. And it's ended up in one or two Sutherland coastal parishes, then one or two Skye parishes, and then one or two out in Lewis and Harris and so on. But it's a terrible shame that this should be lost. As I was saying earlier on, there is no reason why people cannot speak two or three languages. Every language you speak helps the other one, because you see the construction of the language and it helps you with the other language you're speaking. So I'm all in favour of these languages being kept alive. And the BBC does a lot, as you say. And I look occasionally, and there it is, BBC Wales, BBC Scotland, and so on. They're doing a great job. But when you look at the history in Wales, for example, not all that long ago, what is it now? Well, not much more than 100 years ago, any child heard speaking Welsh had to hang around his or her neck. It was called the Welsh knot. And it was Wales do not speak. And he had to listen to anybody else. And if he heard anybody else speaking Welsh, he could give them the Welsh knot. 4 o'clock comes home time. The one who is still got the Welsh knot gets the cane. Terrible. And it's completely inexcusable, absolutely inexcusable. Never should be. Let's hope it can't go on. That's why.
Anybody that hasn't asked a question or made a contribution, if anybody would like to indicate, I'll give them preference. Okay, I can't see anybody indicating with the question. So in that case, it's getting a little bit late, Alwyn. Would you like to give us some parting thoughts?
Well, all right. Trouble is, when you ask me to talk, the question is how to stop me talking. As anybody in my family could tell you. Well, I had a lot of material already, and the Sutherland clearances alone, it was so so interesting. And I keep on seeing, I just bought a book, Morven Transformed, by Dr. Gaskell, a Cambridge professor, who says who said about the Sutherland clearances, he was unfortunately cross swords with local official called McKidd, who he accused of poaching. And McQuid got his own back by accusing Seller of what he'd done, which was throwing people out and burning their houses. Seller was actually put on trial for homicide and burning the houses and so forth. And the history books say he got a fair trial. He had 15 jurymen, being a Scottish trial. And the jurymen were chosen by the court. I'll go into that afterwards. But of the 15, the case was against landlords and big farmers. Of the 15, 9 were landlords, 3 were big farmers, so that was 12 after 15. Seller came from a little town called Elgin, so 13th and 14th members of the jury were from Elgin. So 14 out of 15 had obvious reason to find him not guilty. And very resultingly, they did find him not guilty. And professors are saying, oh, well, they found him not guilty. There's no reason to suggest the jury was rigged. God, how do you get away with it? Anyway, that's it. No more.
Okay, thank you very much, comrade. On the meeting's behalf, I'd like to thank you very much for your contribution tonight, and we'll try to get a list of publications Apple. that have been mentioned tonight and put it on our website. Okay.
Yes,